Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire at occultofpersonality.net. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and your co-host is Rudolf Berger. A Cult of Personality podcast is available on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher Radio, Acast, TuneIn, and all the best podcast apps. This is episode number 183, featuring an interview with Peter Mark Adams, author of The Game of Saturn, Decoding the Sola Busca Tarocchi, published by Scarlet Imprint. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Chamber of Reflection at chamberofreflection.com, as well as all of our patrons who participate via the A Cult of Personality Patreon campaign at patreon.com/A Cult of Personality. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Temple of Thelema is a true outer order of the greater mysteries, providing ceremonial initiation, structured training, and regular group work, all in conformity with the principles of the Book of the Law. An investment of time, effort, and commitment is expected from each member. Each is expected to aspire fervently to the great work, to dare with courage undaunted, to perfect that work, and ever to apply his or her best effort to effect harmony within the order and within the world in general. Founded in service to the AA, College of Thelema seeks to guide the student to an understanding of the Law of Thelema. Most especially, this means a deeper understanding of oneself and of one's true will. A combination of instruction techniques is employed, including seminars, written texts, and individual work. For over 40 years, College of Thelema has published journals in The Continuum and Black Pearl, as well as several books on occult subjects, maintaining high standards in Thelemic education. Visit Temple of Thelema at www.thelema.org. Anathema Publishing Limited. Quality occult books and contemporary esoterica. Established in 2011, Anathema Publishing aims to provide superior literature in content and form by creating a trinosophic relationship in troth and gabo between publisher, author, and reader. Anathema Publishing produces refined books for the true bibliophile on topics ranging from Gnosticism, traditional craft, alchemy, Hermeticism, witchcraft, to Luciferian theosophy. www.anathemapublishing.com. Now, in episode number 183, Peter Mark Adams joins us to discuss his wonderful book, The Game of Saturn. The Game of Saturn is the first full-length scholarly study of the enigmatic Renaissance masterwork known as the Sola Busca Tarot. It reveals the existence of a pagan liturgical and ritual tradition active amongst members of the Renaissance elite and encoded within the deck. Beneath its beautifully decorated surface, its imagery ranges from the obscure to the grotesque. For the first time in over 500 years, the clues embedded within the cards reveal a dark Gnostic grimoire, replete with pagan theurgical and astral magical rites. Careful analysis demonstrates that the presiding deity of this cult object is none other than the Gnostic demiurge in its most archaic and violent form, the Afro-Levantine serpent dragon, Baal Hamon, known as Kronos and Saturn, though more notoriously as the biblical Moloch, the devourer of children. Conveyed from Constantinople to Italy in the dying years of the Byzantine Empire, the pagan Platonist George Gemistos Plethon sought to ensure the survival of the living essence of Neoplatonic theurgy by transplanting it to the elite families of the Italian Renaissance. Within that violent and sorcerous milieu, Plethon's vision of a theurgically enlightened elite mutated into its dark shadow, a Saturnian brotherhood operating within a cosmology of predation, which sought to channel the draconian current to preserve elite power and wealth and control. This development marks the birth of an illumined elite over three centuries before Adam Weishaupt's Illuminati. The deck captures the essence of this magical tradition. This work explores the historical context for the deck's creation against the background of tense Ferrari's Venetian diplomatic intrigue and espionage. The recovery of the deck's encoded narratives constitutes a significant contribution to Renaissance scholarship, art history, tarot studies, and the history of Western esotericism. In my opinion, the Game of Saturn is a groundbreaking study. It reveals evidence supporting the most egregious allegations of conspiracy theorists, including dragon bloodlines, black magic, and human sacrifice. Combined with the wonderful analysis of the unique tarot imagery and symbolism, Peter Mark Adams has created an instant classic and revealed his own talent as a scholar, author, and esotericist. I highly recommend The Game of Saturn. Peter Mark Adams is an author, professional energy worker, and healer. With a background in philosophy, he has been researching consciousness and healing for over 35 years. Peter is also a contributor to international peer-reviewed scholarly journals and contributed numerous articles on complementary and alternative medicine, mindfulness, Reiki, breathwork, energy, esotericism, and altered states of consciousness. Peter Mark Adams, we want to welcome you to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's really a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Greg. It's a pleasure to be invited on.
Yeah, I was delighted to receive and to read your new book, The Game of Saturn, Decoding the Sola Busca Tarocchi. It was from Scarlet Imprint, obviously, quite a fine book, both physically and content-wise, I have to say. But before we talk about the book, maybe you could give listeners a little bit of your background if they're not already familiar with who you are.
Yeah, sure. I'm an author, breath worker, energy worker, mindfulness coach, and an esoteric researcher. I've been researching aspects of esoterica for the last 45 years at least. And I've been engaged full time in energy work, research, and writing for the last 20 years. I've been very fortunate to have some great teachers on the road, one of whom passed away a couple of years ago. His name was Ronnie Colwell, very famous martial artist, and one of the very few Westerners to have reached the rank of 10th degree in jiu-jitsu. I actually studied Shotokan karate with Ronnie for a number of years, and that was a fine experience. I learned more about energy work from Ronnie, I think, than almost anyone else. He was a superb teacher and a highly disciplined individual. Of course, it was only after his death that we learned that he was a Special Air Service operator back in the 50s. And had continued to be a trainer to the Special Forces for many years. I studied rebirthing breathwork with Diana Roberts in London, and a form of energy work and mindfulness with Jim Leonard, quite a famous figure in the breathwork community. I published two books, The Game of Saturn, and much earlier, a book called The Healing Field, in which I tried to bring together the most extraordinary experiences that my partner and I had had over the 20 years in healing, and to look at some of the implications that those experiences have for our understanding of energy and consciousness. Apart from that, I published a number of essays in peer-reviewed journals such as Paranthropology and the Journal of Exceptional Experience and Psychology. That, very briefly, is my CV, mini CV.
Yeah, quite extensive, I would say.
Absolutely.
If I might ask, what prompted you to become interested in this particular tarot deck?
Yeah, I wish I had a nice, neat, linear narrative to explain that. I really don't. It's more like the damn thing summoned me, to be honest. It's very strange. I mean, I've been interested in tarot since at least I was 15 years old, but this deck I only learned about very late. It was purchased by the Italian Ministry of Culture from a aristocratic family who apparently have had it in their hands for I don't know how many hundreds of years, in 2009. And the first exhibition and catalog about the deck only came out 2012 and 2013. So my awareness of the deck stems from about 2013, 2014. And I don't know why I was drawn to it. I think perhaps because it overturns so many expectations we have of tarot decks. We're all used to the allegorical and triumphal imagery. You know, it's kind of mainstream Renaissance imagery. And this deck seemed to violate all the rules of that, and yet nevertheless had the strict format of a traditional tarot deck. And the conflict between those two positions really drew me in. And for a long time, I was just looking at the imagery. You know, I became fascinated by it and perhaps even obsessed by it. And it didn't seem to yield any meaning whatsoever. The deck seems to be structured around a couple of literary narratives, but those narratives don't take you anywhere. And that puzzled me because this was one of the finest decks ever produced, I think, certainly in the Renaissance. It was produced by a master engraver in northern Italy, almost certainly Ferrara. And the amount of work that must have gone into the production of this artifact, I'd estimate at least a year's hard work to design and then draft and then create the engraving plates to produce this deck. And yet there's nothing about it that made any sense. And I was kind of faced with this strange and compelling mystery. You know, why had they done this? Why had they made this strange artifact with all of its bizarre and sometimes disturbing imagery? For what possible purpose had it been created? And that got me really started on the thing.
Fascinating.
If it's not indiscreet to ask, Peter, it seems in what you say about your life background and also by the place you live now, that you have a strong connection, a link between the Western and the Eastern tradition. I don't know if you would confirm that, but isn't that Tarocchi card set we are talking about today also culturally a bit a link between two worlds?
Yeah, I think in a number of different ways, Rudolf. The most obvious way is that I finally located a source for its underlying structure. And that source turned out to be Byzantine rather than Italian. And that was strange. That Byzantine source turned out to be the remnant of a Hellenistic tradition of Thurgic magic, which stretches right back through Plato to the Orphic Mysteries. And hopefully I'll be able to unpack this statement as we go on with the talk.
We should try to do that.
Certainly, yeah. One of the things that I think is very interesting is the way this sort of mystery unfolded in the book. So the reader kind of gets to go along with you. But I'm curious, because it seems like there is so much background information and knowledge that historically and in so many other fields of knowledge that were required to sort of decipher this. And I'm just curious if you want to comment on that.
The deck, I'm convinced, is a masterpiece of esoteric lore. And I think the sources that have gone into it, whilst they seem broad to us, given that in the Renaissance, you know, a very large library wouldn't be more than about 500 books, they had far more depth in their use of the available materials. So this deck, for instance, its historical layer, the historical layer of the trumps and the court cards, can be pretty well sourced to Plutarch's Parallel Lives. And within Plutarch, about three chapters. And that'll give you 50% of the historically identifiable figures within the trumps. The court cards are, well, 9 of the 12 named court cards are derived from the Alexander Romance literature. And specifically from one tale within that literary tradition, which is the tale of Alexander's conception. So just with those two small sources of information, you can now account for the majority of the surface features of the deck. So I hope this helps to unpack it. It's when you get beneath the literary and historical narrative that things start to become complicated, however. And I've discerned within the deck three components that need to be addressed: a Platonic metaphysics, a cosmology, and a ritual praxis, so that the deck actually contains within it the three elements necessary to operationalize it as a working system of thurgical magic. We can go through each of those three components one by one and unpack them a little.
You read my mind. I was going to ask you if you could maybe go in detail one by one on those three elements and then try to find out what sums them up.
Okay, let's take the metaphysics first. What I've discerned within the deck is that there are seven major themes that contribute to its metaphysical worldview. One is what I would call Saturnianism, the centrality of the figure, the ancient figure of Saturn or Kronos Saturn, within the deck's metaphysics or metaphysical system. Now, this particular reference is amplified within the deck by a pattern of repeated references to his manifestation in North Africa. The North African Saturn Kronos was none other than Ammon or Baal Hamon, or better known from the Bible as Moloch. And this is one component of the deck's metaphysics, which is, you know, inescapable. The second key metaphysical theme I see in there is a very fatalistic form of Gnosticism. So that whereas we normally think of Gnosticism as a liberation theology, if you like, a theology that seeks to liberate the individual from the bindings of matter, this deck inverts that process and makes the process of Gnosticism fatalistic, so that it's almost as though the Thurgist is seeking to induce a metapsychosis within the same familial lineal lines. And we, in fact, do find this notion repeated around the world in tribal groups, in the pre-modern societies. Ethnographically, death rituals are often structured around ensuring the rebirth of the person within the same family circle. So I depict this as a key element, second element of the Dex metaphysics. A third one I'd describe as illuminism. This has its origins deeply in Plato's esoteric philosophy. For Plato, I believe that liturgical rites were designed in such a way as to illumine a political elite, so that if they were brought up without family ties, with no wealth or property of their own, if they had what he would describe as a philosophical upbringing, which is, of course, something far more than what we would understand today by the term philosophical, it would include purifications and liturgic ritual, then they would be literally illumined by deity and so capable of running a just society. And I think this concept has been, again, distorted, because whereas Plato's philosopher kings should have no property or wealth, of course, there was never any chance of that happening, either in Athens or, for that matter, amongst the elite of the Italian Renaissance. So you get an inverted illuminism, you get an inverted Gnosticism, all under the shadow of this figure of Cronus Saturn, who, incidentally, I should have mentioned that this Saturn is not the planetary deity. We're not talking about the planetary intelligence, the one of the seven celestial beings. We're talking about super celestial Saturn, the entropic aspect of the demiurge, is perhaps a more concise way to put it. The other aspects of the metaphysics, probably on a lower level, is its central concern with the draconian current. And again, this is a rather bizarre feature to find not only in a Renaissance tarot, but in any belief system. And I think it derives directly from Orphic theology, or the theogony, better to say, in which the serpent dragon gives birth to the Orphic egg from which Phanes arises. The metaphysical worldview that I'm outlining here is unique enough for us to identify pretty well precisely where we can find its source. And that source is in the writing and work of George Gemistus, better known as Platon. Okay, I can add a couple more elements to this mix if you like.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so I mentioned the cosmology. We'll talk about that in a little detail in a minute, but it is wholly malefic. There's no benefic elements in this system's cosmology. I can only take that as implying one thing, that it's intended for elite attack sorcery. I can't imagine how else you'd use the most malefic entities, both planets, fixed stars, and constellations, other than in works of maleficium. The deck also embodies a very strange thread, which is related to the myth of the Watchers. And most of us are used to a context for this in the Book of Enoch. But here we find this thread woven through the deck and manifested in a couple of cards, which capture the what I've called the Babylonian theme within the deck. Now, the reason for putting the myth of the Watchers in there, I believe, relates to a form of sexual magic. And there are a couple of cards in the deck which give formulae for actually conducting that. Finally, I would say the Hellenistic ritual grammar, which is something else we need to unpack. In toto, when you put all this together, you know, it's Byzantine, It's in direct pagan continuity back through Michael Paracelsus in the 11th century and before him to the teachings of the so-called Neoplatonists, in particular people like Iamblichus, and from him back again to Plato and back again to the Orphic mystery cults. That's the tradition I believe this deck embodies.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. So many different directions we could go, but I'm curious, I think you already like alluded to this a little bit already, but if you could try to characterize for us the groups or families or elite societies that might have had access to this knowledge or were connected with this tradition, because it sounds like it's basically the same root of all of Western esotericism, but yet it's got these aspects to it that are, as you say, kind of dissimilar from like standard tarot that we might be used to, or other types of magical texts or grimoires and things of that nature. But yet there's a lot of continuity, I think, from the source material.
Yeah, I mean, I would say a significant missing element in all of this is any reference to Christianity whatsoever. Mm-hmm. That's huge. Mm-hmm. And especially in the 15th century, I mean, given that most of the elite families of the Italian Renaissance also provided the popes and cardinals, the archbishops and bishops of the church, this deck is like the dark side of the moon from all that. So it's a significant omission. The other thing is the emphasis on clergy within the deck. It kind of steps away from most of us know the Abramelin material, for instance. Okay, the deck shares that concern, what Abramelin calls the knowledge and conversation, the holy guardian angel, that ritual. This deck has something like it, but the deck's version of that is dark. The deck's version of that liturgic rite invokes the draconian current in its darkest form. That's to say, Amon. And there's a consistent pattern of references to human sacrifice also embedded within the deck. But let me get back to your question.
Yeah.
I just wanted to separate a couple of threads which push this deck system away from what probably most of us are familiar with up to now. Okay.
Yeah, so certainly.
In 1438, 1439, the Byzantine elite were aware that the empire was on its last legs and had lost most of the territory that they had controlled up to then. They were looking for support, financial, military, and political support from the West, and specifically from the up-and-coming families of the Italian Renaissance. They could not get that. They couldn't realize that. And I think, 20 years before Constantinople fell, the elite were aware that they were about to lose their tradition. George Gemistus Platon was a pagan, a Platonist, the leading Platonist of his age, a ranking member of the Byzantine elite. He was an advisor to the emperor's son. But he was also the organizer of what is called a fratria, a brotherhood, which practiced pagan rites, and for which George Gemistus had written an extensive liturgy in which each of the ancient gods had a fully developed rite for their worship. Coming to Italy in 1438, 1439, with the Byzantine delegation to the Conference of Ferrara, Florence, the final attempt to unite or shackle the fate of the Byzantine Empire to the West, Platon, I believe, had a plan of ensuring the survival of the Platonically inspired Hellenistic tradition that he represented amongst the elite families of the Italian Renaissance. They had the wealth, they were up and coming, and it was probably the only opportunity he had to ensure the survival of his belief system. And I believe that is what happened. The families of the Italian Renaissance at that stage were, I guess, on analogy, Don Corleone would would be an apt symbol. These were the families who come through the great plague, the Black Death, in the 14th century and risen to absolute power and control in their various regions. They dominated those regions and they absorbed the wealth of the regions into their own families. And this caused no end of trouble amongst the ancient communes and the people. There were tax riots that were viciously put down. One family in particular we need to focus on, which is the d'Este line of Ferrara. The peculiar characteristic of these elite families is that, whereas on one hand there was no brutality that they were not ready to commit, on the other side they invested massively in high culture. They were not necessarily the consumers of high culture themselves. In fact, d'Este preferred to read books about King Arthur and the Round Table to Plato or Aristotle. But they were the sponsors of high culture because it was used as a way to impress and to demonstrate their fitness to rule. I think the intellectual and cultural gap between Byzantium and these rather raw families explains a lot of the Dex negativity. The elite families were immersed in demonic magic. It was pervasive. They maintained and protected whole ranks of priests, clerics, monks who were ritual specialists who could be called upon to undertake acts of sorcery in support of the elite families. So any system of magic which offered the opportunity to enhance the power and control on this metaphysical layer would have been welcome to them. And yes, I can cite the inquisitorial records for that one.
I mean, I have so many associations when I am listening to you already when I read the book, but now that you are, well, kind of summarizing and concentrating even more and at the same time opening the knowledge even wider, it has some very modern, almost contemporary facet in it. It comes very close to certain movements of the second half of the 20th century, the draconian movements in Sweden or and Greece, by the way, or Saturnian orders in Germany, like Fraternita Saturni, for example. And all that seems to be, well, it's the wrong way around. It can't be reflected in there, but it's like it's coming out of there. So this darkness, this, let's call it, ancient left-hand part way of doing things, have you got an idea where it's rooted in? Where does that come from?
Yeah, it comes straight out of Platonic tradition there,
right there,
Rudolf. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Plato was committed to empowering an effective elite. All of his dialogues have that one common purpose. You know, the Republic and the laws are, in fact, the textbooks, the manuals for the creation of this elite. And the esoteric side of Plato, which, again, is a topic we can open out if you like. There's some very key texts there, Phaedrus, Timaeus, the Phaedo, Cratylus, in which small sections embody Plato's esoteric ideology, if you like, his esoteric metaphysics. It's not a big step to take that and move instead of towards the illumined awareness of the Christian Gnostics, for instance, the Cathars, the Bogomiles, Paulicians, Brethren of the Free Spirit. All of these movements are parallel to the deck we're talking about. But whereas they have an interest in liberation from materiality, this deck is designed to provide mastery of materiality. And that mastery extends from life to life. So that mechanism is in Plato anyway. He talks in the Phaedrus about the chariot. When a person dies, they are drawn into the entourage of the deity they've worshipped and emulated throughout their life. And this is part of the thergic death ritual. so that their trajectory then is with the deity until the weight of their own unresolved issues pulls them back into materiality. Given that this is a mechanism, if you accept that, it's only logical then to begin the process of selecting the type of deity that you want to worship and emulate, and then to use that connection to ensure a trajectory into the kinds of society that you want to end up in. I mean, you find this in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. You'll see it in the Tibetan Lama's practices. Whenever a high-ranking Lama dies, they wait a while and then go about searching for him, his reincarnation, and then testing the figure by placing, you know, all the articles that he'd used in his life before him. He has to select exactly which ones. So this process of controlling the process of metempsychosis is evidenced in cultures all around the world. And I think in the book I give an example from African culture.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. So this is perhaps something missing in modern Western tradition, but it's certainly everywhere else. The focus on demonic magic, on materiality, again, is not that foreign, given most people's interest in pursuing magic and sorcery. So what we're looking at then is a very extreme example of it, a very sophisticated, long-lived, an elite system. And that's probably the difference. You know, this deck has been, since it was created in what, 1490 perhaps, maybe earlier, only surfaced in 1802 and 1830. Where has it been these last 300, you know, 400 years? It's extraordinary that this artifact should have surfaced at all, that it's available to us today to look at. But it comes from a world which is quite remote. The people for whom this deck was designed ran the church. They ran the political, the diplomatic processes. They ran the military. These were all pieces on their chessboard. And they manipulated that chessboard quite deliberately in order to ensure their own survival. And I think at the end of the day, what we're looking at is a mechanism of elite survival here. And that accounts for its amoral or unethical elements. That given that you genuinely believe your survival as a family is at stake, then what wouldn't you do to ensure it surviving? I think this is the ethical dilemma that they are faced with when this system was presented to them. And the answer is they'd stop at nothing to survive. And this deck is designed to do exactly that for them.
There's a couple things that, well, more than a couple, but some things that come to mind as you were talking about this. One is a lot of things that I've read over the years which lack the scholarship that your work has, to be sure. They might fall under the rubric of conspiracy theory, but generally they're talking about things of a very similar nature as you are now. Bloodlines, survival of wealth and power through the ages, continuation of that, and using nefarious or black magical means to accomplish that. I think we've all kind of encountered this type of literature before. It's presented as factual, but yet the veneer of actual scholarship is thin at best. But what you're presenting is actual proof, a real basis in something that we can look at, that you've interpreted for us, thankfully. But it does support that notion that, you know, the rulers of the world are involved with paganism, black magic, bloodline, sorcery, and things of this nature.
Yes, I agree that, you know, the disconnect that we have with those things is that the evidence is so much lacking in the modern era. You know, we have very sketchy stuff to work with, you know. Bohemian Grove, for instance.
Or, exactly.
The terrible scandal in Belgium about the murdered children and so on. Some very disturbing things, but you can never get to the bottom of them. And perhaps exactly. It's just as well you can't. But here we have stuff. Now, if we unpack the other elements of the deck, if we unpack the underlying Platonic esoteric metaphysics, then this all exists, and we can compare it to established ethnographic accounts around the world. You know, it's well founded in that way. Whether it survived the Enlightenment to become a part of a political culture, whether it was ever effective in a modern shape and form, I don't know. I can't answer that. Okay, my thesis is ethno-historical, essentially. I leave the conspiracy stuff to the people who are so good at that.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. But nevertheless, it does really raise a lot of alarms as you go through it. Not those charges or those ideas were ever like completely implausible at all. I think they certainly are. But to see actual evidence of it in front of you is a totally different experience, in my opinion.
Yeah. How does that strike you, Greg? I mean,
in all honesty, I feel like there are probably a lot of fortunate circumstances and perhaps forces at work that have allowed us to get to the point where I'm holding the book in my hand and we're having this conversation, because I never imagined that we'd be able to see evidence like this. It makes me think that the times that we live in are really much more of an unveiling than in past ages.
Yeah, I think we're in some kind of terminal velocity. And I think all the dirty washing is going to come out.
But it's true that you get the impression that that has speeded up alarmingly, probably even. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's good. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think everyone now has to look to their spiritual connections in life. I mean, it's easy to dismiss one's own mortality when you're fairly fit and healthy. So it's a bigger challenge to take that on board before you need to. And for me, this deck just shouts out that, you know, you need to look at your mortality, to look at how your personal lifestyle matches up to what you're seeing here. You know, are you a fatalistic Gnostic? Are you a liberation Gnostic? Or are you just somebody who's lost in between? You know, these people have made a choice. Their choice is power, and we're going to run the world. And if the metaphysical aspects of reality are integrated with that, then so be it. They get on and do it. But most of us haven't actually come to the point where we've chosen. We can still, like, swim around. We can, you know, check different systems, try different practices. We don't really lock into a discipline for our own illumination. It's far more comfortable to observe others' processes than to lose ourselves in our own, I guess. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
I'm curious of what your initial reactions were as you came to sort of discover these different layers of meaning in the deck.
Well, like yourself, I've been in all this conspiracy literature for quite a while. And to be frank, this deck helped me to understand it on a far more metaphysical level. Whereas before, it had always seemed oppressive to me. Now I began to understand that even the dark side is a part of a much larger spiritual equation. And it forces you to evolve yourself in a more methodical way, in a more aware way. So seeing that such dark forces can have a deep metaphysical roots helps to clarify my own position in relation to reality. So I'd say it's been wholly positive in that sense. I feel far more anchored for having done this.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah, it was a growing experience. Not always comfortable one, but it was a growing experience.
I was going to say, sometimes when you realize what you were just saying, you walk through dark areas.
Yes, indeed. Where we were at just now was looking at some of the key themes in the Dex metaphysics. I can just briefly mention the cosmology embedded within the deck, if that's of interest to you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
The point of entry I had into this puzzle was, strangely enough, Mithraism. Before I started on the study of the Dex imagery, I had been reading up on the more recent research scholarship on Mithraism. So it was very much in mind when I started trying to figure out what the deck was about. And I noticed two cards that seemed to complement each other in a number of ways. One with a figure holding a torch pointed down, and another with a torch pointed up. And I thought, well, that looks like a reference to the torchbearers in the Mithraic Tauroctony, the bull-killing scene. In that scene, they always represent the solstices, according to Porphyry at least, whose classic text on the Cave of the Nymphs would have been available, I believe, to the Dex designer and would certainly have been known to the Byzantine elite. To confirm this hypothesis, I decided, okay, if the torchbearers from Mithraism are depicted in the deck, can I find the bull and Mithras himself? So the bull was easy. There's a card called Deo Toro. Okay, well, that was too easy. Let's see if we can find Mithras. And I found him encoded as Trump 13 Catone. And this figure, strangely enough, is emphasizing the most malefic fixed star in the heavens, Caput Algol, the eye of Medusa. And if you look at that card, you'll see the spear going through the left eye of the Medusa's head at the figure's feet. So with these three clues in hand, I took them as a hypothesis that perhaps the deck embodied other Mithraic elements. The solstices represent the gateways of the sun from Plato, the points in which souls enter and leave material existence. So I first sought to confirm that hypothesis, and I knew that an alternative way of depicting these gates of the sun was with a celestial globe on which two interacting bands are placed, two intersecting bands. So I started looking through the deck to see if I could find this image, and I found it twice, actually. The King of Swords, Alexander, and Trump 21, Nebuchadnezzar, both have the celestial globe with intersecting bands on it. So I was fairly sure now that the deck had been constructed on the back of a Mithraic metaphysics. But it turned out to be false, because Mithraism had seven steps of initiation, one for each of the seven classical planets, and I couldn't find the seven classical planets. What I did find were references, coded references to Mars, the chthonic aspect of Mercury as psychopomp, pomp or guide of souls, Saturn, and the dark or negative side of the moon, which in the Chaldean oracles is called Physis, and it commands the sublunary sphere of demons. So when I put these four planetary entities together with Caput Algol, I suddenly realized that the cosmology so far was wholly malefic. I then set about searching for other indicators of malefic planets, fixed stars, or constellations within the Dex imagery. And I found a couple more, so I was pretty well convinced at that stage that the Dex served a different purpose. It was not an attempt to replicate the metaphysics of Mithraism. It had a far more specialized use. And that very briefly is the cosmology that I discovered within the deck, a series of malefic planets, fixed stars, and constellations.
Do you think you could talk a little bit more about the theurgic or ritual aspects? I'm curious, obviously it seems like the reception of the book's been tremendous, is that right?
I was surprised, actually. I think Scotland Imprint have been surprised as well.
Yeah.
You know, they never planned to bring out a paperback, and today they just announced that there'll be a paperback available.
Yeah,
I saw that. That took me by surprise.
Well, I see people quoting it on Facebook. I've seen a lot of people talking about it. So,
yeah,
certainly is being well received and discussed quite a bit.
Wow, I've yet to see a strong review of the book. Giselle and Godwin will review the book. And that'll be this autumn, winter. He'll put the review in Renaissance Quarterly. Yeah. And another author, Nikita Sinisiolu, is the author of Radical Platonism, an expert on the Byzantine influence on the Italian Renaissance, will also review the book. And I think that'll be in the Ares Journal, the journal of the European Society Western for the Study of Western Esotericism. Mm. So those two reviews will be very late this year. And apart from that, I apart from the fact that the book has sold, I don't have any other feedback really about it.
Well, those are going to be some pretty prestigious reviews. But all the feedback I've heard has been very positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
But I must also say it's one of the most beautiful books, even from Scarlet Imprint, which we are used to get impressive books from. But it's one of the most beautiful books I've had in a long time. Also, the sheer quality of the prints of the cards, the colors, the depth of the colors, it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I should say here that Alcestis Demesha has made a fantastic job with the design.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I have to say the Scarlet Imprint, working with them has just been the most rewarding experience. They know their business inside out. You know, this talismanic publishing is a very strange kind of corner of the publishing world. And these guys really know their business. They understand. They understand the process. And they handle it so professionally. Mm. I mean, tell me what to do next kind of thing. And, you know, it's been a delight to work with them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, their books are fantastic.
Yeah.
I think the choices they made in the production of the book are really excellent. Like, I like the large format because it allows for a really good feel, and the images are large enough that you get to appreciate them.
Yes, indeed.
A little bit more. And I really think that they did it. It's, I mean, I don't have a way to judge because I don't have the originals, but it seems from the book that the reproduction quality of the images of the cards is pretty fine detail.
Yep, and the colors are very close to the originals as well.
Yeah, the colors are amazing, really. Yeah.
You know. We'll see the deck out, I hope, in the next month or so. It'll be the first time the complete deck is published by Scarlet Imprint. Mm-hmm. And that's from the photography from the Brera Gallery itself. So,
oh, nice.
That'll be something. I caution anyone to attempt to revive the rituals. Don't touch it.
Right. I'm not going to say anything.
Okay.
Silence on both sides of the ocean.
Yeah. It should be enough of a warning for anybody.
Yep.
Well, Peter Mark Adams, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It's really been an absolute delight. And the same with your book. Is a delightful, wonderful book on a somewhat dark subject, but really, really amazing bringing forth this knowledge.
Okay, thank you so much. So much indeed. I've enjoyed talking to you both.
It was a real pleasure to listen to you and to get all that in-depth view. It's amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I highly recommend the book, and I hope that, I'm sure it's going to sell out.
Strangely, the fine edition sold out. Like, it's still not available. It was sold out sometime last year, which really surprised everybody. But the paperback will be available. So, you know, hopefully we'll keep this title in print and it'll be available for scholars. And I'm really hoping someone will pick up where I finished and take the process forward, because there's vast chunks of this deck which have still not been deciphered.
Wow, that's something else. And just the work on sort of the implications of it, and huge. It's just a huge, huge material. You've opened up a treasure chest, I think.
I'm planning a series of essays which should be a kind of companion to this book, where we can, you know, some of the issues we discussed today, for instance, can be opened out without the restraints of having to decipher the deck. You know, I had to keep on a fairly narrow path to get through the material. Mm-hmm. But there's so much more in there which I'd like to discuss. I'm planning a series of essays on that, and let's see how that goes.
Well, we'll look forward to that.
That's great, yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you again for spending some time with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Very much appreciated.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you both.
In the Chamber of Reflection, Peter Mark Adams, Rudolph, and I continue the interview at chamberofreflection.com. You'll hear more about the elaborate cover stories that obscure the true malefic nature of the Sola Busca Tarot, the cover stories surrounding Christianity, and more of Peter Mark Adams' masterful analysis. He also talks about morality, psychic vampirism, and much more. Join us for that fascinating conversation. I'd like to remind you that although you're able to listen to this podcast at no charge, the costs to produce it are significant. Your financial contributions ensure the continuity of the podcast. Please support A Cult of Personality by joining the membership section at chamberofreflection.com or via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. And if you're already supporting the show or have done so in the past, my heartfelt thanks, and I salute you. Thank you for listening, and until next time.